Broken Horse, a story of Helen Suitors and the Trojan War. Written and narrated by Amalia Caracella. Inspired by Homer, Pseudo-Apollodorus, Euripides, and Quintus Murnaeus, just a few of the ancient authors through whom a piece of our understanding of an even more ancient people was carried forward. From the very beginning, I swore I would never write the Trojan War. I was sure I had nothing new to say and didn't want to retread the same ground that had been overtrod already before me. But then, sometime after I finished writing By Helen's Hand, I remembered Polypoetes. Who is Polypoetes? A lesser king of a northern tribe and unremarkable by most accounts. There is no real mythology, no real fame attached to his name beyond his attestation as one of Helen's suitors and his inclusion in Homer's catalog of ships. We know he earned a prize at Patroclus's funeral games. He is explicitly named by one source as one of the men inside the Trojan horse, though we don't know what he did after he slithered out of it. And he's the only named son of Pirithous and Hippodamia, who together with Leonteus led their region of Thessaly and the Lapith people in the fighting at Troy. He is a background king who inexplicably takes a front row seat in the clutch moment of the Trojan War, where he continues to be treated as a background character still. In short, for a writer like myself, Polypoetes was an opportunity. One of the things that strikes me about Trojan War retellings on the whole is how they focus themselves so entirely on the same handful of players, the great heroes who were all about fame and glory and embodied what we consider to be the prevailing cultural drives and sentiments of the time. Might makes right. Conquer and enslave. Get that fame and glory. Often, the repeated stampedes of the rest of the men to their boats when Agamemnon tests them in the Iliad are entirely scrubbed out of the narrative. But those moments offer a key perspective. Agamemnon and Menelaus and the rest of the hero kings and princes we all know and love were leading a deeply unpopular war. And there were a lot of people in that camp who were desperate to go home, with or without the sack of Troy. There is no reason to think a background king might not have been one of them. And now we have a new story and untrod ground. We have something different. But Amalia, I hear you say, what about glory and fame? Those were driving forces. Why does every hero get a choice? If a long life and a death of old age at home surrounded by your family is not some kind of temptation still. If they all always choose glory and fame, then the choice means nothing. We have to allow for the fact that there were some people in this society who chose otherwise. It's right there in the construction of the myths. Part of what makes these particular heroes exceptional is that they did choose glory when other people might not. It isn't even going against the grain. It's not modern to look at what is presented as options inside the myths themselves and connect the dots, to take the other path presented. Odysseus never wanted to go to war, but we don't act like that's a break with history. If fame and glory were all that mattered, all that drove the people of this culture ever, then Odysseus would not have play-acted his own madness in order to get out from under the oath he designed. Dozens, maybe hundreds of people have retold this story. But if they keep leaving out the part where the majority of the army really did not want to be there, half of it and all the nuance is lost. To suggest that everyone in the past was driven by a bloodthirsty desire for fame and glory at any cost is a profound disservice to history and our ancestors. And with that in mind, along with a desire to present Paris of Troy with a nuance I felt he'd long been denied, I began writing. And what started as an idea for a novella a little epilogue treat to cap off my Helen of Sparta duology, became a full-length novel that had more in common with works like The Song of Achilles. I had retold the story of the Trojan War. I had written the book I swore I'd never write. And now, I'm going to read it to you, just a couple chapters at a time. But some say that Hermes, in obedience to the will of Zeus, stole Helen and carried her to Egypt, and gave her to Proteus, king of the Egyptians, to guard, and that Alexander repaired to Troy with a phantom of Helen fashioned out of clouds. Pseudo-Apollodorus, The Library. Helen. Surf and shore, sedge and sand and water, the smell of salt and fresh water, and my husband laughing, chasing me into the waves, lifting me up and then faltering, his weak leg dropping us both into the sea, sputtering and smiling as his mother looks on from drier land, a baby, our baby, in her arms. Helen. A hand touched my shoulder, smoothed down my arm. I twitched from the touch, dry and warm, without the crust of salt and sand and the cold water. Helen, wake up. You're dreaming. I opened my eyes, but the man who met my gaze looked like a stranger, and I struggled upright, scrambling back from his warm amber eyes. Eyes that had been sea blue just a moment ago while we rolled in the surf. It's all right, Helen, he said, catching my face in his hands, drawing me back with a soft laugh. It's only me. We're safe. You're safe in Troy. Paris. I covered his hands with my own, letting out a breath and allowing my fear to escape with it. Paris, my husband, my prince. But the dreams, not nightmares any longer, but something else. Just as heartbreaking in their own way. Dreams of another life, just as real as the one I lived in Troy, with a man who loved me, and a daughter so precious. Hermione, how could I leave you so cruelly? Forgive me, I murmured, allowing Paris to pull me down again, though I was not certain my words were for him. Forgive me, my love. Hush now, he said, pressing a kiss to my brow. These nightmares you suffer are no fault of your own, and Aphrodite protects us, just as I promised. We need only keep faith. I breathed in the perfumed spice of his skin, burrowed into the warmth of his body, and thanked the goddess for the peace she had brought. For it had been more than a year since we had fled Sparta by way of Egypt, and still the Achaeans had not come. Not since the embassy just before our arrival, and that, too, had been a gift, for it had allowed Priam to deny us and plead innocence with such convincing honesty that even Menelaus had been forced to pause. But rumor had spread her wings and flown since my arrival, with Paris parading us up the broad city avenue to the palace, refusing to conceal me or his actions from anyone. By now, Menelaus could have no doubt as to where I had gone. You will never be hidden away again, he had promised that day, and though I feared what would come as a result, I could not deny some small piece of me had thrilled at his words. I had spent so many years trapped in that palace in Sparta, always conscious that I must keep my hair covered and my body from sight, that I might not attract any attention from my husband's men, from Menelaus himself, truly, too. And it was a relief at last to ride out into the sunlight again, to see and be seen by the world around me. A relief, too, to give up this long struggle to prevent my fate, to simply live and love and let the gods have their way. Because I did love Paris. I had missed him while we were parted in Egypt, when I had spent my days among Pharaoh's women. And once we were reunited, it was as though I was seeing him with new eyes. I could not understand why I had fought so hard against him, against the fate the gods had chosen for me. Time and again, he had told me we should take what pleasure we could, that we should not fear what comes after, or let it keep us apart, for the gods had given us to one another, and who were we to defy them? And time and again, I had argued. But for what? Loyalty to a husband who would keep me caged? In Sparta, as Menelaus's wife, I was a queen in name only. I could not protect my people, could not serve them at all. Why should I not at least serve the gods? Was that not also my duty? As a daughter of Zeus and a queen of Sparta twice over, I would not fight any longer, not for anyone or anything but myself. Part 1. Paris. The Achaeans are raiding the islands, Hector said, standing before the dais in full leather armor and still covered in dust and dirt from the road. Their strikes are swift and brutal, and they leave no man alive. The women and children they take as slaves, infants too young to be of use are killed or left to die, motherless and alone, in the ransacked villages Achilles and Odysseus have left behind. It is only a matter of time now. Let them come, Deiphobus said. We will stain the beaches red with their blood, and they will turn tail soon enough. It is one thing to raid a village with 1,000 ships of men behind you, but let them try to breach our walls. We will cut them down by the hundred. Hector did not take his eyes from Priam's face, ignoring their brother, and Paris shifted uncomfortably on his bench. That not one voice rose in agreement with Deiphobus's bluster, that every gaze was trained upon Hector and Priam, barely even daring to breathe, it did not bode well. Surely they will come to us with terms before they strike, Priam said. Menelaus will demand his wife return to him, and Agamemnon will want gold and trade goods for his troubles. Helen is not a prize to be bargained away, Paris snapped, rising. Or do you forget she is my wife, that we are married before the gods, with Aphrodite's blessing no less? To part us now would give grave insult to the goddess. And keeping her here will kill hundreds, perhaps thousands, Hector said, emotionless. Always so calm and self-possessed, it was impossible to know his mind. These last years, Hector had argued every side, never revealing his true preference or desire. Some days, it seemed the only thing Paris knew of his brother with certainty was his love for his wife, and that only because his hands gave him away. The gentle sweep of his knuckles against her cheekbone, or his open palm pressed with hope against her stomach, the way their fingers knotted together at every opportunity, as if they could not stand to be parted. His hands, and his utter indifference to Helen. Only a man deeply in love could fail to be stirred by her beauty. You do not know that, Paris said. The Achaeans might well tire of their raiding and warring before they even reach our shores. Menelaus will not rest until Helen is returned to him, Paris, Hector said. Perhaps you were not here when he came to reclaim her the first time, but you must have seen some sign of his character in Sparta before you stole her away. Helen herself has told us the other kings and princes are all sworn to his service in this. They cannot turn back until he releases them. The kings and princes, perhaps, Paris agreed, but not their men, not their soldiers. They did not compete for Helen's hand, and they made no vows. In Achaea, without the consent and support of their assembly, a king has no power. It will not matter what promises they made if their men lose faith. Even Achaeans cannot be so faithless as to turn upon their king while they wage a war upon a foreign shore, Hector replied coolly. Certainly not while they are winning women and slaves, their holds and decks filled to bursting with livestock and plunder. Riches which will be shared among their kings and princes first, Paris insisted. And not enough from a few island villages to satisfy anyone. Hector shook his head. All the more reason for them to fight, to lay siege against our walls in the hopes of a greater prize. But Troy's walls are unbreakable, Paris said. Our city protected by the gods and favored by Zeus himself. They have no hope of success, and they will see that for themselves before long. A few weeks of sleeping in the sand with nothing to show for their efforts, and there will not be a single man among them who is not eager for his home. We can outlast them, Hector. any siege they lay, it will not be enough to starve us, and they cannot touch any of us behind these walls." "But what of the people outside of them?" Priam said at last, his hands turned to fists in his lap. "Our neighbors and allies who suffer even now by these raids. Do you think if we hide behind our walls, the Achaeans will not find other sport, other blood to spill, and other prizes to take?" "Let Helen speak with these kings who seek to defend her, then," Paris said, pleaded truly, for if he did not persuade them now, he would have no other opportunity. "Invite them to send an embassy to the palace, and let them see with their own eyes that she was not taken against her will, that she is not stolen, but rather fled. Once they know that Menelaus lost the faith of his own wife, surely they will see reason." Priam lifted his head, his gaze finding Hector's in silent question. Paris had watched them engage this way 100 times, exchanging 1,000 words with only a look. It was a language Paris had never learned to speak, raised upon the mountain, among the king's livestock instead of in the palace, to prevent exactly this, if Cassandra and Oenone were to be believed. He grimaced at the thought. He had sent a messenger up the mountain after his return to the sheepfold he and Oenone had shared, but the man had seen no sign of her or his son, nor had Aglaus any word of her since Paris had set sail to Salamis and then Sparta. She had taken Corythus from him, and he was not even certain he could blame her for it, not when he had returned with Helen. Not all of the kings and princes who sail with the sons of Atreus were Helen's suitors. Achilles, for one, is not beholden by any vow. As far as we can tell, he fights only for glory and fame. But the others... Hector hesitated, considering, and Paris ground his teeth, his whole body tense with need. If he could not convince his brother and his father to fight for Helen, to allow her to remain, he did not know what they would do, what they could do. "I do not deny that Helen might well have power over those men, over all men. But it is still a risk, for if she fails, we are committed to war. There will be no guarantee that giving her back will be enough to appease them after blood has been spilled." Priam nodded, leaning back in his chair and rubbing his bearded chin. "We will consult the priests, and I will pray. Until their ships reach our shores, there is time yet, and I would make the most of it. Whatever comes, however our fates have been woven by the gods, we must prepare ourselves for the worst. Send word to our allies and friends that Troy may have need of their aid and support, and begin gathering supplies." "Of course, father," Hector said, inclining his head. "The messengers will leave today." "Hecuba?" Priam asked. His mother had stood silent throughout, her face a mask, the same queen's mask Helen had once worn, before they had gone to Egypt, before they had left it again as lovers. "We must ration our grain, and whatever might be harvested now is to be brought inside the walls. What is not yet ripened will wait until their black ships blot the horizon, but the very moment the Achaeans are spotted, every able man, woman, and child should be sent out to the fields, with soldiers to guard them and lend their own backs to the work," the queen said. "And we must not forget the gods. Now, more than ever, we cannot neglect our duty. I will oversee our offerings to the goddesses myself, but I will expect every son and daughter of this royal house to make proper sacrifice on behalf of our city as well." She pinned each one of them with her gaze in turn, waiting for a sign that they had heard and understood. When Paris met her eyes, they softened, and after he had inclined his head, she touched Priam's shoulder. "We will remind Achaea's kings that Troy has only taken what it was owed, an Achaean bride to replace the Trojan princess who was stolen. If they do not like it, let them appeal to Telamon and his sons. Tell them we will give back Helen only after Hesione is returned to us." "She will never leave Salamis," Paris said. It was why he had been sent to Achaea to begin with so long ago, and she had made her feelings quite clear when he had offered to bring her home. Hecuba smiled tightly. "Exactly so." Even if he could not know Hector's mind, with her command, his mother had made her own feelings clear. Whether it was for his sake or for Helen's, it hardly mattered. It was simply a relief to know he was no longer fighting for her alone. Enjoying the story? Get early access to new episodes of A Broken Horse by becoming a patron on Patreon, www.patreon.com/amaliad, AMALIAD. Or learn more about Amalia's works at blog.amaliacaracella.com.